But to give you an overview on the industry in the U.S. and where it is these days. So, and I thought I'd start because
it helps. Can you speak up,
please? Try. New Yorker, I usually do. And I thought it might be useful just to put the U.S. market in context by looking at the U.S. and the rest of the world, because it's a very different perspective. Just to get some perspective, if you look at the world wine market, producers all over the world have produced, there's been a fundamental surplus in wine in the world since World War II, basically, or at least since the 50s. And it's primarily European wines. If you're as old as I am, you remember hearing about the European wine link. But that affects all the other markets in the world, because the solution to that has always been to export. The Europeans have tried, since the Common Agricultural Policy started, something you really don't need to worry about if you haven't, but basically they were subsidizing all kinds of agriculture in order to bring their members together, ended up paying people to produce anything that looked like a crop, whatever the quality, including grapes, which produced a lot of really bad wine and really poor quality grapes. And then they kept trying to find ways to cut it back. They'd pay people not to plant, they'd distill the wine, they'd store the wine. At the same time, if you actually look when the world wine market really started to change, it actually goes back to 1943 at Davis and the real application of modern science to viticulture and enology, which has now spread around the world. So there actually is very little bad wine made in the world. Maybe one you don't like, but very little bad wine. So you get a lot more wine of better quality coming out of all different parts of the world and the Southern Hemisphere, whether we're talking South Africa, Australia, other parts of Latin America, also discovered that wine is something they could produce and something they could sell. Whereas consumption primarily grew in emerging markets in the U.S. And so you have replanted vines, you have improved agricultural techniques throughout the old world, Europe, and new investment in new world wine production. And then Argentina, who's the one non-European country considered a traditional wine producer, really, as I'm sure you've all learned very well, really dramatically changed and upgraded their wine production. But Europe still accounts for 47% of all vineyard acreage, and despite all the cutbacks that have been made, and probably a comparable amount of the wine coming out of the world. And they have invested, they adopted the European agricultural policy in 2008, their viticulture policy, of which a ridiculous amount is spent on wine. So they, since 2008, they've spent 1.2 billion euros on promoting wine exports from the European Union. And meanwhile, European internal consumption has fallen dramatically, as much as 50 to 75% in many countries. Although what they are drinking is better wine. If you just look at the total number, it goes like this, but the share of better wine in that is increasing. But then they have to figure out what to do with all the other stuff that's being produced.
What's contributing to the fall? What's contributing to the fall?
A lot of it is culture. I mean, people initially just blame the anti-alcohol laws and things like that, but wine has fallen more than spirits, than beer, and champagne consumption is usually up, sparkling wine, champagne consumption. So it's really a cultural thing, and consuming wine is a very cultural product. It's about where you stand in the world, where you think you fit in a social context. It's among the most cultural of products. And what's happened is wine has been marketed throughout, and there's great data on that I left out of here because then we just talk about Europe. But wine has been marketed in most of Europe as a commodity on price. If any of you have ever bought wine in the UK, which was the largest import market in Europe, you see it, but also in any grocery store in France, it's sold on price. And then they do things, and there's a wonderful Jensis Robinson piece on this, they'll say that, you know, this £3.99 sterling wine is marked down from 79 sterling, so it's a great buy, and it's actually £4.25 sterling that they've marked to £3.99, or it wasn't even marked down at all, they marked it up. And so the mass consumer really doesn't see the point of buying it other than as a commodity. And within France and Italy and Spain, who are the largest producers, you go into all the research on who's drinking wine, and basically it's just become a product that older men drink. It's seen as that plonk my grandfather put on the table in a juice glass, except for the very high end of wines, which are really only consumed by the very high end of the population. It's not considered an aspirational product, unlike what it is here, unlike what it is in most of Asia and most emerging markets. And so doing that, I mean, it's really testimony to what happens when you market an aspirational product as a commodity. People just don't associate it with sophistication, modern youth. Very few women drink wine in France now. The French definition of a regular drinker is a bottle a day. In the U.S., it's you know, drinking any wine once a week. So, you know, we're on a different planet. But it's gone down. The number of people who have wine with dinner in France has fallen to below 25% of the population. And so it's really a cultural thing. It's not about, they're drinking beer and spirits, craft spirits, cocktails doing really well. Champagne usually does well, except when the price is going nutty. So it's really a cultural issue of how you market the product. And wine is an affordable luxury, but it's a luxury discretionary consumer product. It's easier to compare it to fashion than it is to a foreign product.
Sorry, Barbara, I will give you this so you don't do the click and you don't have to
okay.
use the...
Okay, thank you.
No.
So what do I do?
You just click.
Does it work? I have no problem doing the whatever. That's okay with me.
Helps
you remember what I'm...
Just watch where you're standing because the projector is...
We can't
oh,
see
I see.
It.
Right. I'm sorry. So I'll do that. Or do you want to sit there and go click?
All right.
We'll do that. The manual solution.
Yeah.
Old school,
but yeah, now you have to. Aquí, dale click.
Here.
Here's
up and down.
No, I know, but I just
want
to try.
Okay. Ahora tienes que desenchufarlo porque quedó.
So I mean, so if you look at this, you can see how much wine has expanded in new parts of the world. And by the way, China now has more acreage planted to vineyard than California. Some that includes the data wine is so bad. Includes grapes and raisins, but it's still, and a lot of the Chinese vineyard land is not very good, but they're working on it and they're investing a lot of money in it. But you can see the growth in the new world while you're still getting this massive production out of Europe despite the cutbacks. So if you look at what's happened to back when, so in percentage terms, new world has really gone up. But the percentage declines have been relatively small despite the massive cutbacks. And actually, production, Spain cut about 20% of its acreage, but its production is still up because it has improved viticulture techniques. So we have a world in surplus. Go ahead. So wine consumption has shifted to, you can see where it's growing. It's growing in the U.S., it's growing in China, it's growing in Russia, which is interesting because they keep trying to cut it back. Growing in the U.K., growing in basically the BRIC markets, the emerging markets, and a little bit in Germany and Northern Europe. And in the traditional wine-consuming countries, it's pretty much all down. So you have a very concentrated market for imports. And always remember when marketing wine, it's a cultural product. It's a social, it says something about who I am, what bottle I put on the table. And you can see changes in per capita consumption. So they're going up in basically the southern hemisphere in Russia, and they're going down through most of Europe. And so you see the shift really dramatically here, where age has really picked up. The U.S., America includes all of the North and South America, and even though we're increasing, given it's lost some market share in consumption because of the rapid growth in Asia. And if you go back one, and you can see the decline in Europe from... And it is still the largest consumption area. It's just dropping severely and consistently. Go ahead. And what you see in most emerging markets, and which is where the traditional countries are trying to export, is it tends to be a bimodal market. It's a very high end for the newly rich, and then the rest of the people are really drinking very low end wines. There's usually a missing middle market in there because people don't know enough to be able to spend money on wine other than by brand. You know, they'll buy Lafite and they'll buy anything Bordeaux in China because they don't know enough to distinguish between good and bad. And they're afraid of making a mistake. I mean, wine has all these social implications. And so everybody, therefore, is exporting. The whole solution to everybody's surplus is to export. And they're spending money on it. In the last year, the EU spent 238 million euros, which is what, close to $300 million, on export promotion. Most of that, the single largest target is the US, followed by China. Australia is 20 to 30 million Australian dollars. It's actually 30 to 40 million Australian dollars. They are putting a lot of money into this because they have a huge wine surplus. I mean, their mistake at the beginning was to look at the US, say, oh, great, it's a growing market. 60% of the US market was wine under $6, $7, so that's what we'll produce. What they didn't notice it was a declining market segment. So they ended up with this extra volume of low-end wine, and they have to figure out a place to put it. Chile, which spends less money, is still focused on exports. It's basically an exporting wine market. The U.S. spends a small amount of money on exports. We export relatively little. We're sixth in exports. And South Africa and New Zealand spend a certain amount of money. So a lot of people are promoting exports. So the U.S. In the U.S., wine consumption in the U.S. has increased every year since 1993. Everybody in the industry sort of blames it on the 60 Minutes 1991 program about the Mediterranean diet and red wine being good for you. You could attribute it to a lot of things, but it basically has grown consistently every year since 1993. Wine sales in the U.S., 360 million cases. And it's the number one finished agricultural product. But, you know, what else can you grow in the ground and then sell for anywhere from $10 to $200 or $300? There are bonded wineries in every state. Most of them are in California. And California is 90% of all the wine produced in the U.S. But the interesting thing is the growing share. 2009 and 10 were the first time in at least a decade that the U.S., that domestic wine gained anything in market share. We basically lost, we've gone from 90% to now 58%. Well, California 58%, the U.S. overall just under 70% of market share in the U.S. as imports have taken a larger share of a growing market. And one of my favorite lines from an old friend, the U.S. is the only major market import market where sales of wine over $10 a bottle are growing. So we have become the major target for all exports in the world. And if you look at U.S. import trends, Argentina is this purple line there, which is, you know, it's this tiny little thing. And then you see it in the last few years increasing, but still a relatively small part. Italy and France dominate imports. They have the largest volume, although, in all honesty, it's interesting what's happened. We can talk sometime about what's happened to French imports in the U.S. They've had a major when I was growing up, that's what you drank. They've had a major problem marketing in the U.S., which is comparable to their problem marketing at home. They really have lost what they used to do really well and what they do in Asia extremely well, which is how to present the story of French wines as a luxury romantic product. The Italians have done pretty well. Argentina, you have trouble giving away these days. It really boomed and now it's, you know, it just became Yellowtail. And
Australia.
I'm sorry.
No.
But you know, you can't. It's just so embarrassing. I'm sorry. Spain has done well. It kind of had a little rough time in the depths of the recession, but Spain has done well. New Zealand has done well, but it's become basically limited to being New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, stuck in that $15 to $20 category. And they're a little frustrated with that. And France has picked up in some odd parts of the market, and we'll talk about that a bit. So let's talk about who drinks wine in the U.S. it's actually a much smaller market than anybody thinks. Every time I look at somebody investing big money in some industry, in some, you know, tech startup in the wine industry, I want to shake them because, you know, they drink wine, they think everybody does. 49% of the adult population ever drinks wine. Okay, that's fine. But of the people who drink wine regularly, 18% of the adult population of the U.S. Two-thirds of the wine volume is bought by one-quarter of the consumers. It's a highly concentrated market. And we have not been very good at expanding that market. That 18% 8 years ago was 14%. I don't think that's a big improvement. So we're preaching to the converted, and that's an issue. And if you look at the demographics, however, if I have a similar table for the French, which, you know, we won't divert to, but it's almost the opposite. But what you can see in here is basically beer traditionally was consumed by young guys. There's a wonderful phrase from somebody's survey of guys drink beer with each other and wine when they're with women because the beer was too raunchy for women to want to drink in social occasions. Craft beer has really changed that. And craft spirits has also changed that. So you can see some growth in both beer and spirits in both millennials and Generation X, and as we'll see in the next table, among young women. Wine still is the drink that women are more likely to consume. Beer is the drink that young men are likely to consume, and then spirits for older men. But there should have been a second one of those. I guess I didn't. Okay, there should have been one on gender, and I apologize. But anyway, wine is still basically more of a woman's consuming product in the U.S. as opposed to France. It is amazing how different. Go ahead. And also younger people. Although more people drink wine as they get older. They move from the beer to the wine, usually somewhere in their 40s. Craft beer and craft spirits have really had a real impact on our industry, which we've generally ignored because it's a very self-reverential industry. But the cocktail movement cut into aperitifs, some white wine and sparkling wine. But now craft beer, for $15 you can get one of the very best craft beers, or you can get a glass of wine. So what are 20-somethings drinking? They're drinking craft beer, male or female. So that's really the growth sector in the U.S., in the U.S. Alcohol market. Here's the gender table. So you can see wine is still more likely to be what women consume. And men will consume, the percentage drinking of men drinking wine has increased over the last decade, but a noticeable increase in liquor, which used to be white spirits and now tends to be craft spirits, aged whiskeys, all of that. The craft beer and spirit are really using wine style marketing to catch up. The wine demographic, it's one of the most attractive demographics in the U.S. market. Income's over 75K and usually over 100K. At least college educated and a remarkable percentage of people with graduate degrees. Empty nesters, 45 years or older, and also because it's hard, you know, when you have young kids in the house, you're not going to put a bottle of wine on the table. So we often underestimate the number of 30-somethings actually drinking wine. Professional, managerial, entrepreneurial occupations. And women buy the majority of wine, but men buy the most expensive wines. Men are the cult wine collectors. We have not reached out to minority groups in the U.S., whether it's Hispanic or Asian or African American. It's basically, we're marketing wine not that much differently than we were in the 50s. And purchasing power, it's usually occasion-based. You'll buy this wine for dinner, this wine for, you know, dinner with the boss, this to take, and, you know, you'll buy a different wine for every day than you will for a special occasion. So it's occasion-based, not a lot of brand loyalty except for a few iconic brands, and we'll get back to that. And a heavy wine consumer drinks more frequently, doesn't drink more drinks at a time, drinks wine more frequently. So it's increasing the number of occasions on which people consume wine that we can grow the market. And a quick thing on the structure of the market, which is U.S. wine laws. I just realized I wrote something for an organization a couple years ago that kind of went through the legal structure of U.S. wine. And I probably should have brought copies or I can send them to send
we
to you.
We actually just had a session on this this morning. So
okay, I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay, but we're
and
familiar with the nightmare
lunch?
Of it.
I mean, it's just... went to a lot of the litigation research, and I'm always astonished at the things I find in alcohol beverage laws around the country. You can lose your license for having your license on the wrong wall in some states, for having the wrong bottles in your refrigerator. It's just bizarre. Since you've gone through this, basically the issues that matter are there 14 states where you can sell wine in grocery stores, including some of the major markets in the U.S. study that we did a couple of years ago for the Food Marketing Institute. You'd probably grow wine sales in the U.S. by over 30% if you just allowed wine sales in grocery stores, because women don't tend to want to go in the little package stores, and people think of wine, I'm getting food for dinner, I'll also get a bottle of wine. You split that out, you really change the wine market severely. And then you have the famous story on franchise states, which you probably heard about today. So be careful who you sign a contract with. So the rest of it, you've already had, thank God. But a short summary of the U.S. wine market. And as I'm sure Kara will tell you better than I will, it's much harder to sell the wine than to make it. And basically that's why. And I think this is now an overestimate given what's in there. That's a couple year old number. So if you look at what happened through the distribution channel, enormous concentration. And in most states, there are really two dominant distributors. And it really got worse since the recession. And there are no national distributors, so these numbers are compiled. And actually, the only place that I ever find that I get this stuff is from the Impact newsletter. And more than a few lawyers have said this is an antitrust suit waiting to happen, but nobody's going to sue the distributor or they'll never get into the market. So it's an all very strange experience. Everybody makes a lot of fuss about consumer direct. It's only about 3% of total sales. It costs $10 a bottle to ship this stuff. So it's insignificant for wines under about $20. It can be 20% on average for wineries above that. And for those who have really built a reputation, it can be your major source of sales. On the other hand, you need to have an O2 license to sell wine in the US, consumer direct, so then you have all kinds of other issues. Most internet wine sales, and very little of consumer direct, is internet sales. And most of the internet sales in the US are from brick and mortar stores, because people buy a selection of wines. It's that brand loyalty thing again. This idea that people call up every day and buy a case of wine from their favorite winery is a fantasy. So people will go to a trusted retailer, a K&L, a Sherry Lehman, or Specs, and order a group of wines from that retailer more likely than they will go and order wines they haven't had from the winery.
Barbara, how is Amazon doing with wine sales?
It's still very small. So basically in the structure segment of the wine market, and especially if we look at it till 2008 in that bubble, and you know we've come back to this now, but it always surprised, okay, how many people in this room, a friend of mine, Leslie Joseph at Constellation loves to ask this, how many people in this room have had wine costing more than $15 in the last week? As Leslie would say, you are not normal. Um, 60% of the volume of wine in the U.S. that's sold is under
$7.99. Whoa.
And another 30% or more is $8 to $15. The volume of wine that represents the wine most of us like to drink is 6 or 7% of the volume in the market, probably 30% of the dollar value of the market. The core of the market and where the growth is really here, at $8 to $15, $8 to $20, depending on what year you're in. And that under $8 segment, which is the one the Australians targeted, has basically been declining since 2001, except for the first 6 months of 2009. And then in September 2008, along with everything else, the market for wine just fell off the cliff. Everybody just stopped buying things. And for the next 6 months, for the first time in a decade, sales of wine under $8 rose. And what happens there is they're just trading market share, because they're just a handful of producers who can really sell at that pricing. And the other thing that happened that's longer lasting is distributors dumped inventory. Credit became very hard. Things stopped moving. And the finance people and the big distributors simply said, get rid of anything that's been on the shelf more than 30 days. If any of you buy from flash sale sites, that's where they got all their volume in 2008, 2009, and even now. It's distributors dumping excess volume. Distributors also started firing suppliers. They fired overall the major guys about 25% of their suppliers. And then on-premise restaurants and retailers started cutting inventories as well. Stuff wasn't moving, holding inventory is expensive. And you saw all that turn up in auction houses and flash sale sites. So sales came back to the regular structure by mid or late 2009, and sales began returning to $20 plus wines, but real resistance to anything above $20 and certainly above $30 unless it was on sale. And as retailers would say, if it was $60 on sale for $30, I could sell it. If it was $30, I could sell it at $20. Before the crash, a lot of the large wine retailers and the grocery stores have been adding more higher-end wines, more small production wines. They had expanded. The typical SKU count in a grocery store for wine was about 450 SKUs. A lot of them moved up to 1,500 to 3,000 SKUs. They were moving up by adding smaller high-end brands. All those got closed out in 2008, 2009, and got replaced by volume brands, by wines from Constellation and Gallo and Foster's or Treasury, and all of those folks, simply because they moved and the consumers recognized that the consumers weren't willing to spend that kind of money anymore. And consumers have remained very value conscious. There's been a lot of growth at the high end, but there's been growth at the high end for strong brands. So we've had some real structural changes in this market that really are built around the whole tightening of inventory management and sales costs. So in retail, consumers began shifting from wine specialty stores to chains, grocery stores, places where they bought other things. The retailers just go by concentrating their shopping in a minimum number of sites. And then there's this wonderful phrase that I hear from retailers called assortment rationalization, which means they took anything off the shelf that they didn't recognize that sold fast. You know, so it could be, I never heard of Grenache, I'm taking it off the shelf. Or, you know, I never heard of this, or I never heard of that brand. So it got down to, plus the big companies started paying big promotion allowances. This is technically illegal in a lot of the country, but for most things in grocery, you pay to be on the rack by the checkout register. You pay to be on a corner thing. That it's illegal in wine. It started happening in wine. Big promotion allowances. What the independent retailers started focusing on then, if the single largest U.S. brand is Kendall Jackson Vintage Reserve Chardonnay. That's what people come into the store to buy, and then the retailer would convince them to buy something else in the wine store. Well, if that starts being priced at barely break even in the grocery store, the chain store, then what do the independents do? You see a major movement towards private label, not just private label, more importantly, direct imports. And there's been a major growth in independent retail as well as on-premise indirect imports from overseas. So they can bring things in at a price competitive with the big US, the sort of well-known value brands in that $10 to $15 segment, depending where you are. And discounting pressure's leveled off, but it's still implicitly there. Basically, it's very hard to sell anything over $30 and certainly over $50 that people either haven't had or aren't familiar with. Consumers have become much more conservative with money, but they also found during the recession that there are a lot of great wines out there at $10 to $20 to $30, including, Malbec took off, but also what people discovered was, you know, Argentina, Spain, parts of France, southern Italy, made some fabulous wines that are $15 and $20 and $25. Why am I paying $60 for some no-name Napa Cabernet? So there's continued pressure and the independents had more and more pressure to drive people into the stores because they weren't coming. So the large retailers have restocked shelves. Everybody's looking at, and so you're seeing a lot of this. They have to order for things that aren't in the big box stores, and the big box stores are focusing on the big volume brands because that's what's turning over quickly. And Bordeaux, that uptick in French wine sales is a lot of direct imports. and under $50 and under $20 direct imports. And people really do use WineSearcher if they're regular, so they can compare, you know, why should I pay this price here if I can get it at a cheaper price somewhere else? And they're using WineSearcher, the frequent wine consumer is using WineSearcher a lot. The consumer gets very brand conscious as the price goes up. If I don't recognize it, it's sort of great for the Silver Oaks and the Rombauers and a few other cult brands. It's very hard to be a new brand in this market. And it takes labor and it takes skill, and you're not going to find that in the large retailers or even in the less sophisticated small retailers. The consumer is much more adventurous in that under $20 segment. Also, the younger consumer is more adventurous, but again, in that under $20 segment. And retailers are actually buying from the flash sale sites to save money, and there are still massive closeouts from distributors regularly. Anything, basically, the distributors have moved to, domestic wine has to move in 30 days, imports 60 to 90 days, and it takes 90 days for the wines to get here. So a lot more out of stocks among distributors, and they don't care, they'll just sell something else. The restaurants are much more creative. The restaurants almost immediately started redoing their menus, redoing their offerings, whereas all that the retailers largely did was discount and clear out their inventory. So what the restaurants did was really diversify into more interesting wines at a lower price that could not be compared with retail pricing. So you also get more interesting wine selection among the restaurants. Much more creative. Everybody's working inventory these days. The stuff has to move because it costs money. And they also cut the number of bottles they had, if anything they had in stock. And they're avoiding, restaurants are increasingly avoiding what's available at retail, which is a little bifurcation in the U.S. market, because traditionally you built your reputation in the U.S. by the glass at retail at restaurants, but if they're serving different wines than are in the retailers, how do they follow up and buy your wine? It's a real puzzle out there. So wine inventory is still below 20% below where they were in 2007. There's been a faster growth at the high end, but still not like 2007, except in some segments. By the glass has been moving again pretty well at higher prices, and it's still the best way to introduce wine. But now there are beauty contests for to get on by the glass list because it's such an important marketing device. Carafes are coming back, more wine flights, more interesting pricing, some very creative stuff happening at restaurants. Basically, restaurant margins are also falling apart, which makes their margins for wine more important. Although some places are starting just flat markups on wine so that it doesn't escalate as much at the higher price. But it's really, this whole story is really about the change in the distribution network. So the wholesalers started doing, they won't hold it. As a friend of mine put it, the wholesalers have started triaging their suppliers. There's the strategic suppliers, as they call them, the Diageos, the Constellations, the Gallos, the people who sell tens of millions of brands of wine, and especially if they sell spirits, because that turns over very fast. And that gets a dedicated sales force, priority and everything, and they will hold inventory for those guys, only way they can get their accounts. And then there's the national suppliers, the sort of million case supplier, we know we can move this on volume. And then there's the maybe I'll return your phone call suppliers, who basically are small producers without powerful brand names, and they'll ship your order, they'll take the orders, but they are not doing the kind of support they were doing in the past. They're charging special fees, the special fees for partial cases, special fees for mid-season orders because they're not holding inventory. They dropped a lot of the library wines. If somebody wants a library wine, that's a special fee. So all these things to improve their cash flow. And it's really felt by restaurants because most restaurants don't have storage capacity. So the restaurants have to deal with a lot of out of stocks. At first they complain, now they're living with them. So either, you know, when they want to do a big by the glass promotion, they either have to take one of the national brands in stock and go into any hotel chain. It's almost all Constellation, Gallo, and Treasury wines. There may be one other wine in there, and that's because that's the only thing they can get if they want to have all, they want to have a list that's common across their chain. That's the only thing they can get in volume. And it's rational behavior for the distributors. It's a logistics business. It's an economy of scale business. Wine turn rates are a fraction of the turn rates for beer and spirits. And during the depths of the recession, wine turn rates fell to 12 months. A bottle of wine would sit on the shelf for 12 months. inventory costs 2% a month. That's the whole margin. So they're acting rationally for their business. It just really creates problems for smaller producers. So basically, in small wine needs to be fine wine needs to be hand sold. So go ahead, and they're also starting to expect promotion allowances. Go ahead. So you know we have this triaging, and so the sales and marketing role for the larger distributors is going away, or being reserved for special clients. So if a turn rate of 6 times per year, you have to do your own sales and marketing, basically. They had the most appalling, the distributors had prehistoric inventory management systems. You would not believe some of the stories. They finally have decent ones, so they know what's on the shelf, which makes it easier to dump it. The trade is learning to live with a new system. Even prestige restaurants are learning to live with a new system. So you're seeing some things happen. There's spin-offs from the big distributors of guys who really want to do good wine. They're charging larger margins, but they are trying to hand sell. They're trying to do quality wine selling. Or people are partnering with more. A lot of the guys who used to do hand selling have created sales and marketing companies for smaller wineries. So we'll get you the orders. All your distributor has to do is sell the product or deliver it, basically, which is what a distributor is. Some beer distributors are moving into wine because they're better margins. McLane fascinates me. It's a company that Warren Buffett owns. It's considered the most sophisticated and efficient grocery distributor in the country, which means they have networks everywhere. It's a logistics operation. They're not going to do hand selling. They are calling the larger producers and saying, you have national sales forces. You don't need hand selling. You need cheap, efficient distribution. So here, we'll do it for you, which will then move out of the distributors some of their most profitable clients. And that could really dramatically change. McLane's bought distributors in Tennessee and Georgia, franchise states, you'll know, and it has applied for licenses in 800 states. So that's going to be another big change in the market. So we'll continue to grow wine sales in the U.S. We are continuing to grow them. The higher end market is reviving, but primarily for stronger brands. There'll be continued growth of direct imports, which are a very important part of the story right now. And not very sexy, but a very good, I mean, Malbec, I could do a whole thing as we do a trade survey every year on what's happening to different varietals, and I didn't do it for this, but Malbec is still doing really well. Argentina is still only known for Malbec, but it's doing well. But the other thing that I found for Argentina and Malbec is after the initial explosion, a lot of the trade is narrowing down to a limited number of suppliers because it just got to be too many. But there's still interest. That's one of the segments that's growing disproportionately right now. But it's a question of finding your way through this market structure and either building your brand or finding a channel that will allow you to build a brand. So I think that's there. I'm done.
Wow. Yeah.
Thank you.
You stopped on the appropriate point for Carrie to talk a little to us. I mean, you've spent a number of years creating some very high-end wines and then creating brands and selling those wines. As Barbara said, that the hard part isn't usually making great wine, it's selling.
It's getting rid of it. Yeah, I hate to make it sound so crude. I mean, I'm fourth generation in the California wine business, and if I turn around and take a look at what I've done in the wine business over the years, I basically have started brands, manage large wineries, small wineries, and what I currently do for the last 12, 13 years is I put in Napa Valley and a few other places, I put wealthy people into the wine business. So we're building wineries, I make wine for some of my clients, we through access of people that I know in Napa Valley, and either it's the architects or it's salespeople or label designers or people who do marketing or distribution and distributors. I used to spend a lot of time with distributors when I used to run Sterling Vineyards in Mum Napa Valley for Seagram. It is understanding how, for you who want to get into the wine business, what is going to be your access getting into this. And so my typical client that I see and whether they're focused on, I just opened a new winery in Arizona for clients in Arizona. They're going to launch the Arizona wine business because we built a winery that's a custom crush winery, you know, what you're doing, and it's an access for the people in Arizona, although very small, to get into the wine business. But still the challenge is going to be, like all of you have, is what is it that's going to be your access of getting into the market? Now, if your production is very small, obviously you should be very focused on hand sale or in the area where you are, whatever that means, area where you are, whether you're going to have Argentinian wine in, or wine from Argentina in United States, or you're going to keep your wine in Argentina. If you're thinking small number of cases, you really need a sound plan that will give you the access to some level of market. The problem that we've got in Napa Valley, our prices are high. Everybody wants to make the next killer bottle of Cabernet because we're very Cabernet focused. Cabernet, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, and Pinot Noir are sort of the Northern California wines of big record. And they'll make the expensive wine, they'll go to market, we'll spend a fortune on barrels and grapes and farming and, you know, go right on down the list, and they'll end up with bottle costs of, their bottle costs can be $50, $60, $70, $80 a bottle built in the early stages of getting into the business. And now, if they're savvy, they're going, my God, I've got all these costs, I've got this very expensive wine, I need to sell this wine. And I've got a product that is exactly the same as everybody else's in Napa Valley. So the challenge in how you get yourself out of that hole is recognizing what area of the market you want to be in. So if you're from, I have a client in that lives in Manhattan. We're just doing a new brand for him. It's called Payone. And he's in Manhattan. He's in real estate hedge fund. And convinced him that really his market is where he is, and he and his wife are very focused on the ballet in New York City. So we didn't do a brand that had anything to do with the ballet, but his access is going to be their name, their brand, in all of his contacts in Manhattan. And the brand's small. I mean, he's going to produce 300-400 cases a year from his vineyard that's up in Mount Veeder. So you've got a small brand that the challenge is, and certainly the challenge in Manhattan is you need a distributor to be able to sell in Manhattan. That really isn't the typical case across the whole country. But he's going to focus on the market that's at his hand, and then also dreaming that a small amount of his wine is going to be sold, a small mailing list, an email list, and he'll sell a small amount of the wine to direct sales to people that he know or people that find him. You know, you always hope that there's you know, the over 90 point score from Parker, the Wine Spectator, or whatever that's out there is judging wine, and then, you know, you want to, you know, plaster that information around everywhere so that you think that everybody is buying wine on points. I think points are much less the critical buying point for consumers now. Yes, a wine that a $225 bottle of somebody's Cabernet in Napa Valley that gets 96 points, of course they're really proud, but how big is the market for another plus $200 bottle of Napa Cabernet? It's out there and it's collectors. But one of the things, there's several, I think you keep calling it flash, I don't know if I don't know that I would call BP Wines flash, but BP Wines, interesting website. They send out a daily email, and you see all these brands at somewhat discounted prices, from very expensive wines to wines that end up being probably most of them over $20 a bottle. And some of the brands that you see that are sold are actually surprising, because we would consider them brands not really that are very available. But they are. So we have a very congested market here in the United States for small brands that are all trying to play to the same expensive restaurant. They would love to have a distributor pick them up, and as you saw here, distributors are getting rid of brands. They don't need another small brand. But if you're going to have a brand of any kind of depth and size in this country, you have to be in the distribution world in this country. So one of the things that's interesting that I've seen happen in the last few years is some of the brands that do sell have something to do with other than the wine. You know, there's a couple rock stars around that their brands are sold out. If any of you are famous on some other level, that's one way that you can have something, some kind of sales. Did our rock star just walk in? You can generate some sales. In Napa, the big challenge right now is for many of these people that can't afford to build the, and I build a lot of wineries for people that can't afford the, well, I'm going to spend $2 million on a winery and I'm going to spend $1 million on a vineyard. Well, you start out at $5 million on the vineyard, you grow very expensive grapes, you have the best viticultural company. You set out, my budget's $10 million for the winery. We're doing one right now just north of St. Helena, and we're going to be cresting $25 million for the winery and all of its accoutrements that go with it, save the millions of dollars of inventory that we're going to have in the warehouse. So you have a huge expense getting into the business. So a lot of people don't want to do that. They want to do it custom crush, and I understand that's what your business is, and custom crush is great. I actually make wine in 6 custom crush wineries up and down the North Coast, and it's a great way to keep your costs down. I don't know how your custom crush operation actually works. A lot of people think that when they're going into custom crush, they actually get to play in the wine. You know, I get to do the pump overs and I'll be there tasting out of barrels, because my barrels will be laid out across the floor, except unfortunately they're in the warehouse, stacked 6 high, and it's not very romantic. But it's a way you get into the business is custom crush operations. So that you start custom crush, we're going to make the best wine, we're going to hire a winemaker that has a great name that's going to carry me forward, because everybody has to have wine made by one of a collection of winemakers, and that winemaker will be my access to selling the wine. I've got a great viticultural company, but I don't have any place really to sell the wine. And we just, during the downturn, the 2008-2009 downturn, we lost our distributors and a bunch of restaurants across the country now don't carry our wine anymore. So we're just kind of, we're lost, and what do we do? And so I've been, one brand that I've been helping for over 10 years on an on and off basis, I started, pushed as many buttons I could for the last few weeks for them to just see if I could open up any doors for them. And most of the doors are really kind of closed from the way that they have been selling their wine in the past. But where they're from? They're from Park City. And so they're not really, Park City is where the Olympics were, the Winter Olympics a bunch of years ago. And they all made their money in real estate in Park City. They all live there now. Unfortunately, a couple of them left Napa Valley. So they're gonna do much more of a focus on where their stomping ground is Park City, except that their challenge is their wine is really expensive. So what do you do about really expensive wine? You either limit your production so that you are sort of selling to the amount of cases that you can, but then that even then limits yourself further in the future being able to pick up distributors. They would really like to be able to get into the distribution world or have distributors so that distributors can wholesale the wine around the country. Their product cost is so high that by the time the distributor gives them 50% or pays them 50% of their suggested retail price, they're selling every bottle at a loss. So the focus then becomes, let's do a hospitality room. Let's go to a city in St. Helena, Napa, Calistoga, and let's have a tasting room. We're in the restaurant business. We have a restaurant here in the city called Gott's. We have a big one in St. Helena called Gott's Roadside. And right next to us there's a tasting room that was built next to our restaurant. We're packed and they have no business. Their tasting room is nice, beautifully done on the inside, but they don't do much business there. So they spend a huge amount of money to get a hospitality location on a busy street. They're just barely south of downtown St. Helena, and yet they're not really generating any sales. Now you go into a town like Healdsburg in Sonoma County, and a lot of the tasting rooms are packed. I don't know that I figured out exactly what makes tasting rooms really work, or a hospitality room for a brand that doesn't have a winery. But they're viewing that as a way that they can get people in the door, sit down, I've got staff there. Hopefully they'll buy a few bottles of wine. For some brands it works in proper locations, and there's other brands that haven't been able to pull it off in a lousy location. That's currently the one of the focuses that we see going on in Northern California, is get yourself some kind of hospitality organization. Barbara, you brought up Napa Wine Company. Napa Wine Company has a lot of APs in it, alternating proprietorships, which actually makes it so that you're legal to be able to sell wine in a tasting room that they have at Napa Wine Company. And so the people who have APs and O2 license there at Napa Wine Company, they rotate through various brands being able to sell in that tasting room. I think it's moderately successful. But where the money meets the road for what really works in Napa Valley, and again, you got to remember, we're the second largest tourist attraction in United States, or in California, and Disneyland being first. And so we're always packed with tourists, and what the tourists want to see is they want to go to wineries. And, you know, you go to, if you've ever been to Rombauer Winery, a very small tasting room that's not even as big as this whole room, it's a cocktail party. And people really like the style of the wines. They like being cramped in this little room. They know Rombauer because it's distributed everywhere. And it is part of the hospitality scene. The next piece of the hospitality scene is having a very expensive winery. And basically, no, you guys can't come to my winery, but all you have to do is drive up to the driveway and push the button on the gates, and the gates will open, and they'll ask who you are, and you can come into the winery and taste wine. So we're very hospitality focused on selling the way too many brands in Napa Valley, and I'm probably doing 3 new brands right now in Napa Valley that we're not even on the market yet. But they all have the love of getting into the business. So what I'm trying to get at here is that it's the focus of what do you think your wine is going to sell in what area? What is the focus? Do you have a group of friends that are going to buy all your wines? You can't live with that one. Dwayne Hoff, I helped him years ago start Fantesca, which is in St. Helena. We bought a winery. His wife is the daughter of the founder of Best Buy. And great couple, live in St. Helena now. And they started their brand, so they came first to market. Their first vintage of wine sold out like crazy. The brand is called Fantesca. The second vintage was released, sold very well. So that would be in good economic times. The third vintage of wine came out, a little bit larger volume, and it didn't sell. I mean, it sold, part of it sold, but right on top of it was coming the fourth vintage. And Dwayne had a friend, and I just think it's classy. The friend said, well, you've reached NFL, and I'm going, NFL, no friends left. And you have to be careful with that, is that to develop a brand that you think all your friends are going to buy all your wine, they will definitely buy it the first time and probably the second time, but don't count on it. That's not where all your wine is going to go. The people in Park City who have a brand, they're there, they all spend a lot of money, they run with a good crowd in the town, and their wine is in every high-end restaurant, they say it's on the list. Actually, my encouragement to them is to do a brand, a lower price. Their Chardonnay sells like crazy. Their Cabernet sort of sells. But if they really wanted to expand their business and wanted to do something and do a lot of wine, certainly in Park City or in ski areas, they have a name that's sort of focused on skiing. Go to a lower price Chardonnay. I mean, we drink Chardonnay like it's water. Go to a lower price Chardonnay, get your hands out of custom crush business and do lower price Chardonnay. They don't want to do that. They want to stay high end. And I totally understand it. The other one that is important that I see so often in Napa Valley is people want to get in the business because usually it's the man, we're going to drink, you know, we're going to drink Cabernet. Cabernet is for men, and men among men. We're going to have these expensive wines, it's going to be big wine, and we're going to really enjoy it. And they're making more wine of high prices that has a small segment of the market. And yet the opportunities, probably more so, is to get into a, and probably from grapes from, and wine from Argentina, like what you're doing, but I'm very uneducated about your whole access to what you're doing in Argentina, is to get into a segment where the wine sells at a more moderate price. And I would suspect by the time we get wine through your organization, your winery, and you probably at a more realistic price point. So you have wine at a more realistic price point. Is it what the consumer wants? You know, I think that when I see people buy wine, yeah, there's brands that I buy, and I occasionally buy wine at Safeway. Safeway and Sunshine, and two places in St. Helena besides brands that I make. And probably a third of the wine that I buy are brands that I know or styles that I like. And then two-thirds of are brands that I don't know, and maybe a third of is wines that I make. I think what's important is that you focus on where the market is. Don't go make something that people aren't drinking and restaurants don't want. Frequently have people who want to make, I want to do a blend of two-thirds Cabernet and one-sixth Cab Franc and a little bit of Merlot. And so we got this. Where does it end up on a restaurant's list? Red wine. Other red wines. That's not very exciting. And yet the concept to do the blend, I totally understand. It makes sense from a winemaker's point of view. But that's where the winemaker should start and where the practical end of marketing of the wines should start. Then there also is, what does wine taste like? And I don't know, I'm sure everybody's here has Rombauer. I live right around the corner from Rombauer, north of St. Helena. And I know the family very well. And when I first started making wine as a custom crush client, not as their winemaker, as a custom crush client inside Rombauer, I think their Chardonnay sales were probably something like 30,000 cases. And it is probably I don't know the number, but it's probably extremely far north of 200,000 cases a year. And what's the wine? It's American oak, it's malolactic, it's a lot of new American oak, it's full malolactic, and it's 0.7 residual sugar. And the stuff tastes great. I mean, I like it because it tastes great. You got this big wine, it's got a lot of oak, and it's got a malolactic that isn't too oppressive, and that's what turns Rombauer's tasting room into a cocktail party. You go there on a Saturday and you can't even walk in the door. So there's always a challenge with clients, my clients, and I think some brands, that people are not focused on what is actually selling. Now, it doesn't mean you can't be obscure varieties. Randall Graham and all the brands that he's done and the cute names and everything they did over the past, he was out on a lot of different varietals. And he pulled them all off. And he pulled it off with his very creative writing, his very interesting production techniques. It was one of the first that really got the big story out there about biodynamics. And that was a big piece of what he did. He had very creative names that bordered some on stupid, but they all worked. Somebody was there behind him that said, you know, that one doesn't work. And then the other ones that did work. So he was a creative, very creative person, did a lot of interesting names, and made his wine sell by actually just the unique character that he is. And Bonnie Doon was a runaway success. There was not nearly as many brands around at the time. And the artwork that he did, the label designs that he had created for his brands were quite interesting, and they're great stories, like La Cigar Volant, you know, which was the spaceship that were not allowed to fly over sections of France. I forget what part of France it was, Burgundy or the Rhone. That was a concept of a Rhone varieties that he did. He had a storyline behind it. But there was a very creative person that did it. So looking at what we got going on down in Arizona, here's a group. We built this custom crush wine. There's a large area that can grow grapes. It's not huge, but there, in a few years, there'll probably be a couple thousand acres of vineyard. We did a custom crush winery there from one of my clients. And you can see that that is the leapfrog of how Arizona wines will grow. I mean, and you ask anybody who lives in any town in Arizona, just about everybody, is there any Arizona wines? And they'll all say, no, we don't make wine in Arizona. So the industry has a very long ways to go to be able to get out of, we don't exist, to, well, we sort of exist. You go into restaurants, there's never any Arizona wine. So there's an industry in its infancy. Now, the way it's going to work is to not have varieties and wine styles that consumers are not really drinking, but try to stay in the norm of what consumers are drinking, but hang the Arizona name on it. They got a long ways to go, but we put together a winery with a lot of good equipment, and the vineyards are going to be very modern. So we got a ways to go, but it'll be interesting to watch that come together. So the marketing is a real challenge that so frequently we want to do unique things. And years ago when, I can't think of how many years ago, probably two decades ago, I was in Argentina, and you know, the industry I think was very different, and we were actually more focused on sparkling wine at the time, and not so much on table wines, and also looking at Chile at the same time. And getting the industries have profoundly changed, and I think my son buys a lot of wine from Argentina, yeah, for his brand Joel Gott, and Three Thieves and Bandit. They are focused on an upcoming variety with Malbec that really has an opportunity in this country, and it's come off the bottom shelf, and it's now running along here somewhere. And so how do you get it up to here is, you know, the continual push of marketing support. You know, it's Food and Wine magazine that writes something about it, it's wine writers that write something about it, it is all of the pushing of advertising, whatever creative advertising people and promoters do for getting the name out there can actually continue to have it grow. And then obviously when you bring that one up, something else is coming along the bottom that's going to chase you as you come up.
Well, that's actually the perfect segue, because the next session is on just digging into that marketing. How do you, once you have the wine, how do you market it? I think this was a really good context.
It just occurred to me that in our trade monitor, which we do every year, which is digging into the 70% of the wine trade that never gets reported in any data, we did a thing, part of that was about what's happening by region and by brand. So if you have a minute, let me just show you. I thought everybody needs a little cheering up. So so let me take, if I can, just take a couple minutes.
Sure.
To, where's the whatchamacallit? Here we go. But we asked about Argentina, and we asked about varietals. And we did part of this for the Chileans, who get very upset about this, because Argentina's doing better than they are, and they don't like that. First of all, so about Malbec, and then a thought I had when I was putting this together the other night that sort of builds on what, and it'll just take a couple minutes. First of all, Malbec, I would hear these stories from on-premise about, you know, Malbec's either the socially acceptable Merlot, or it's the less tannic version of Cabernet. You keep trying to figure out some reason why Malbec is taking off, but it really is. It is becoming the sort of red Pinot Grigio, the thing that's just falling off the shelf. And in some markets, it's become the number two red wine. It's mostly Argentine. You're seeing some of the big groups trying to cook up something called Malbec and sell it. But you know, Nora was here yesterday. Wines of Argentina has done a really good job. I think Embrace Your Inner Tango has got to be one of the best marketing routines I have ever seen for wine. And the wine and the food and the culture and all of that. So there's an excitement about Argentina. There's definitely excitement about Malbec. It's focused on that mid-price segment, but there's an opening in some channels, in some parts of the country, to more expensive Malbec. There's not much for $100 Malbec if you see any, and I know some extraordinarily good Argentine producers, but there is opening in some channels, carefully selected channels, to $20, $30, $40 Malbecs. And you could just see that's happening. And then about Argentina, let me go back to something else. which all led me to think about something yesterday that I will just throw out there, then you can go talk about the next discussion. They're still having trouble selling more expensive Argentine wines because people aren't used to it, although Argentina's moved up from the bottom shelf, as Corey said, to its own space. It didn't used to have its own space. It's crowding out the Chileans. It's getting them upset. And they're selling some high-end on-premise, and they're beginning to really like it, especially people who've been to Argentina. So, you know, the best marketing is always to bring the trade down to the region. But they're also experimenting beyond Malbec because they like this Argentine concept. And then thinking back to what I was saying about private label and control label, what control labels are is, and you see these at Cost Plus World Market, and it's where Blackstone and some other major US brands started. It's a label that initially is sold only in certain channels. So they get the benefit of we're the only people who carry this, and then goes national. But you get that initial lift from that, and that's how a lot of major US brands started. But the independent trade and the on-premise market, especially the smaller markets, or the smaller on-premise groups, are looking for something different than what that's similar to, but different than what's available in the big channels that you get things, get big volumes on price. So I kept thinking, and I'll throw this out there, and you can throw me out of the room, but there may be a case for going to some of the specialized wine retailers and on-premise things and saying, you can have exclusive on my brand. Or you could have a few of you together exclusives on my brand, and we'll be your control brand for very special wines from Mendoza. And you know, that's what the French are doing. It's the only way Bordeaux has finally found a way back into the market. The Italians have been very good at it because the alternate white, you know, everybody's looking for an alternate white on premise, and it went from Veneto whites to Santorini whites to, but and then the alternate reds were something from South Italy. But it's finding that segment of the market that's looking for something different that's not available in the big from the big volume chains. And that's one way to grow your market, and you service them. And so you won't have your own, you know, flashy little whatever. You'll be in only certain locations, but it's in their interest to move your wine.
Barbara,
so that was my great inspiration.
Are there any demographics on men, women, Malbec, Argentina?
Yeah, I do, and I'm trying to remember. Not for Argentina. Men are more likely to drink red. Women are more likely to drink white. Argentina, there's not enough volume out there for data, but it seems to be what we do in our trade monitor is we talk to the top wine guys in about 80 of the major on-premise, non-scan data, so non-grocery, on-premise and off, the major independent retailers and restaurant sources, both independent and some of the chain hotels and restaurants. And Malbec just seems to be doing well with everybody. Although something in my mind tells me that they were trying to figure out why women liked Malbec, because they were thinking, okay, it's less tannic than Cabernet, which isn't always true. Then they couldn't figure out the reason. But there did seem to be sort of favorability of women reaching for Malbec, men still more likely to reach for Cabernet. But Malbec is doing really well, and Argentina has a great image. They've done a very good job. Which means that people in the trade are looking to respond to that without having to have the same things that are in the big channels, which can give you an opening, unlike a lot of unlike another one of the $6,200 Napa Cabernets. I was in a family winemakers tasting last year, and behind some trade guys who said, who are these people and why should I care? There must have been 50 $50 Napa Cabernets. You're not doing that. You're doing something different, and you should benefit from that. So that was a little bit of optimism.
Casey?
Why don't we take like a quick break, and maybe we can talk more with Carrie and Barbara afterwards?
Great.
Maybe some questions and answers for them?
Perfect.
So if you guys want to take a break, we'll be back here in 15 minutes.